Both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur deserve their own slots, but we have a limited amount of time this year, so we're going to try to connect them. And to connect them really means to bring them and the entire intervening period into a single unit. That is, that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur both belong to a period of time that's called the Aseres Yimei Tshuva, the 10 days of Tshuva. Days in which we are told that we have a unique opportunity to gain an audience with the master of the world in a way in which we don't have during the rest of the year. There's an accessibility in this period of the year that we don't ordinarily have. Since the topic did read, have something to do with the voice of the shofar, I think we really should ask ourselves, what is the voice of the shofar? There's a well-known short story that inquires about the voice of the city, the voice of New York. What is the voice of the city, or what is the voice of the shofar? Maimonides indicates that it's a call to wake up. It's an alarm clock. That the shofar is a way of trying to draw people's attention to their lives, to that which is most important about their lives. Wake up, ye slumberers. There are numerous other reasons that are given, or numerous other kinds of significance that we are supposed to draw upon when we hear the voice of the shofar. We're supposed to remind ourselves of Maimad HaSinai, the fact that when the Torah was given, that the shofar sounded. We have to remind ourselves that when Mashiach comes to redeem the Jewish people from its millennia of exile, that the shofar will once again be sounded. We are to remind ourselves of that heroic act of the Akedah, where Avraham bound his beloved only son upon the altar in deference to the divine command. Those and many others are all things that are called to mind by the Akedah. That are called to mind by the shofar, that is. The shofar really represents a beginning and an end. It's a beginning in the sense that it's the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah. There is no other mitzvah on Rosh Hashanah other than the sounding of the shofar. So we begin the Aseres Yimei Tshuva with the sounding of the shofar. And we conclude the Aseres Yimei Tshuva with the sounding of the shofar. At the very end of Yom Kippur, the way in which we signal the fact that the fast is over is that we sound the shofar. And to the extent that this is not an accident, it is not a Torah law that you have to sound the shofar at the end of Yom Kippur. But the practice is most certainly drawn on some precedent. In any event, in practice, in our current practice, the 10 days of tshuva begin with the sounding of the shofar and end with the sounding of the shofar. So the shofar cannot be seen in some sort of parochial light. It is not just something that trumpets the beginning of the year, because it's something that is well into the year. It's not something that merely declares or proclaims the end of a certain period of time, because it comes at the beginning of time. So it must be understood to be a beginning and an end. The shofar of Rosh Hashanah has some distinct sounds. We recognize that there is a tekiah, which is the solid blast. That's followed by the trua, which is a variety of broken sounds that the Gemara tells us is intended to resemble a person who is crying, who groans, who sobs. The staccato-like sound is the person who initially begins first with a sobbing and then breaks into a almost hysterical kind of a cry. And then it concludes with another solid blast. At the end of all of our sessions and rounds of blowing the shofar, there's a Tekiah Gedola, one very sustained and long blast. The great Tekiah. Now we know that that is a mitzvah of the Torah. A person who fails to hear the or to sound the blasts of the shofar is missing out on one of the mitzvahs asay of the Torah. That's not at all the case with the sounding of the shofar on Motzei Yom Kippurim. And yet there is a Torah origin or a Torah precedent for sounding the shofar on Yom Kippur. That happened once every 50 years. It's a mitzvah that you have to live a long time to celebrate twice. Every Jubilee year, when Yom Kippur came, there was a sounding of the shofar. In fact, much of what we know about the sounding of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is derived in the Talmud from the sounding of the shofar on Yom Kippur. What does the sounding of the shofar on Yom Kippur accomplish? We have as follows. In our agrarian society, we have first 6 years in which a person tills the ground, sows the ground, nurtures, prunes, does all the things, harvests, threshes, does everything that's necessary to cultivate and harvest the land. And the seventh year, he allows his land to fallow. He does not do any of the critical activities on the land. A year which is really given over to spiritual pursuits because one is not preoccupied with the material pursuits. And this takes place seven times. On the 49th year, you again have a fallow year, having just succeeded the 6 years of planting. And following the fallow year, you have a jubilee year, which means that you have 2 years in which the land lies fallow, in which it is not cultivated, in which you have to depend upon the crop of and the harvest of the 48th year. On this 50th year, there's a very interesting series of things that occurs. All properties, which in the span of the previous 50 years, the preceding 50 years, had been sold by their original owners, that is, people inherited from the family going back centuries, they would inherit the family holdings. If during the course of that period of time they traded or sold properties belonging to them, on the Jubilee year, without any exchange of money whatever, those properties reverted back to their original owners. Some people like to see in this some form of socialism. Redistribution of the wealth from those who had acquired or accumulated a great deal of real estate, it all goes back without the exchange of any money. There's another very interesting thing that happens on the Jubilee year. There's an institution of servitude in Jewish law, whereby if a person should commit a certain crime in which he has stolen goods or money, the value of which is either equal to or is more than his work of 6 years, that individual, if he cannot pay back the value of what he stole, will be sold by the court into a state of servitude as an eved ivri. Now he has it's a protected state. It's a very, very well protected state. In fact, the Talmud says if somebody is stupid enough to buy an eved ivri, he should recognize that he has purchased for himself not a servant but a master, because there are a great many amenities that accrue to and are accorded to the Eved Ivri. Nonetheless, it is a state of servitude. The state of servitude lasts for 6 years, generally. At the conclusion of the 6 years, he goes out. He goes free. But if the Jubilee year should interrupt that six-year stint, he would be set free without any further need to serve. Let us say, for example, that a person has served his 6 years, and the time has come now for him to go out in an ordinary stint of service. Now what happens is that at the conclusion of the 6 years, he has been given an indentured slave woman as a wife, which is the master's prerogative to do. And he is enjoying his state of servitude. He lives a protected kind of life. His master is responsible for his medical care, to see to it that he is fed, that he is housed and sheltered, for his clothes. It's his master's responsibility. And he has a wife and kids, and he comes to the master and he says, I'd like to hang around here some more in this state, given the same responsibility. So they go to Beis Din, and a little hole is bored in his ear, in the soft part of his ear. And he must declare in the presence of Beis Din, Ohavti es Adonai, I love my master. Es ishti ves bonai, I love my master, my wife, my children. Lo etzei chavshi, I don't want to go free. In that case, he continues to serve beyond the 6 years and continues to serve until the Jubilee year comes. In the Jubilee year, there are no options. He must go free. So the Jubilee year, in addition to the redistribution of wealth, it forces all those slaves who have opted to return of their own free will into a state of servitude, it forces them to go free. Gemara in Rosh Hashanah makes the following observation. Amar Rabbi Shmuel ben Yishmael Rabbi Yochanan ben Breker. Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Breker, made the following observation. Meireish Hashanah Adyeh Makipurim, on the Jubilee year, from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, the slaves did not go back home, meaning to their original home, not the home of their master. At the same time, their masters were no longer free to force them to work for them. They were free to eat, to drink, to enjoy their new status. When Yom Kippur came, Taku Beis Din B'Sheifa, the Beis Din would sound the shofar. Niftu Avodim Levotean, the slaves would go back to their own original homes, and all of the fields would be restored to their original owners. So we have a peculiar state here. Between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they were neither here nor there. They were no longer slaves, but at the same time they were not free to go back. So something had to happen between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur of that year. Something which I think we have good reason to believe is also incumbent upon us to do if we would like to partake of what this time of the year offers us. We need to understand what is the delay here. We also need to remember that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur historically have certain antecedent events which are very important to us. Rosh Hashanah is the day, we are told, upon which Joseph was freed from prison. Little known event. Joseph went out of prison to interpret the dream of the Pharaoh on Rosh Hashanah. So on that one day, he went from being a prisoner to being the viceroy of Egypt in one instant. He was summoned from his prison to become a king. We also know that on Yom Kippur, Moses came down from his third 40-day session on the mountain, when Hashem at long last declared that he was going to forgive Klal Yisrael with a full heart, and that he gave Moshe on that 40th day, he gave him the second tablets of stone, and to commemorate the fact that he had forgiven them, that day was, which was the 10th day of Tishrei, became known to us as Yom Kippur, the day of forgiveness and atonement, and it's also the day of our receiving the Torah the second time. That's the day upon which we came down with the tablets that were whole. Interestingly enough, the comment of our sages, and Rashi cites it for our benefit, before Moshe went up for that third period of 40 days, Hashem said to him, Moshe, go up alone. Don't take anybody with you. Let no person ascend the mountain with you. You got to go up alone. And the comment of our sages here, the first luchos, which were given with pomp and circumstance, with all the nations of the world hearing all the noise, and there was great fireworks and thunder and lightning, and it was a majestic show. That which was given publicly, that which was given with an international audience, they somehow became the object of the Ayin Ra, the evil eye, the envy of the nations, and consequently they were shattered. There's nothing that is better than tznius, nothing better than this quiet, private, modest encounter. So that Moshe was advised to go up the second time, he was advised to go up in the most private and modest circumstances. Needless to say, it was also on Rosh Hashanah. Wait a minute, let's finish with Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur was also the day which, according to some shitas, cited by the Aserem HaMoreh, who was a disciple of the Ramak, and I believe the Ari HaKodesh, he says that according to some opinions, that it was on Yom Kippur that the Akedah took place. That was the day upon which Avram went up to the mountain to offer up his son Isaac. And of course, finally, Rosh Hashanah is the day upon which the world celebrated the appearance of Adam upon the scene. The creation of the world began on the 25th day of Elul. The sixth day thereafter was the day upon which Adam was created, and that is our Rosh Hashanah, the appearance of man in the world. Now, we do have a little bit of a problem. When we talk about Rosh Hashanah as being the beginning of the year, we have a rather explicit contradiction, because it is written in Parshas Bo, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodesh, and this month is the first of all the months. Vishnu Lachem Luchad Sheshana. This is the first of all the months of the year. So it would appear that Nisan, the month in which Pesach appears, is the new year. Whereas we celebrate the new year on the first day of Tishrei. So how can you have two new years? In fact, there is some question. How do you know? Where do you see? You don't find any place in the Torah that explicit that the first day of Tishrei should be referred to as Rosh Hashanah. It's a borrowed item. When the Almighty talks about his love for Israel, the land of Israel, he says, this land which you go over to inherit, it is a land of mountains and valley and hills. Wait, Bika is? What is Bika?
Meadows.
Horim?
Holland.
I think it's a valley. It's not a valley. It's a valley. I think. Yeah, right. Because it's a valley. The Imtana Shemayim Tish Demoyim. It is nurtured by the rains of the heavens. It is a land which the Almighty seeks. That is, the Almighty visits this land. Tomi Deni Hashem Lekechabo. Constantly the eyes of the Lord your God are upon her. Mereshis Hashana Vadachishana. From the beginning of the year until the end of the year. And from various derivations and interpretations, we learn that Mereshis Hashana Vadachishana represents from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. So that's where we have a point of reference for the first day of Tishrei. And we go through the sequence of derivations. This now becomes the time in which Hashem visits the land of Israel. And our sages tell us that when he visits the land of Israel, he at the same time, when he decrees what's necessary for the land of Israel, he also at the same time decrees what's necessary for the rest of the world. So we have two New Years. One that's called Reishis Hashanah, the other one is called HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim. And I guess we really do have to ask ourselves, how can you celebrate two New Years? We also note the fact that these two New Years are very, very different in mood. The Rosh Hashanah, which is denoted by Pesach, is a very festive time. It's a fun time. So the mood is a very happy one. The mood of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, this Rosh Hashanah, which is now upon us, is a mood which is a very serious one, very introspective, very somber. It's heavy. So each one comes with its own mood. Chiddush Yerim says, one of the early Hasidic greats, he repeats in the name of the Baal Shem Tov a very curious statement. He says that the Baal Shem Tov said that in reality, Rosh Hashanah is best accounted for by people doing what they need to do alone in their homes. He said, except for the fact that it's a day of Malchus, it's a day of proclamation of God's sovereignty, and Berova Mahadras Melach, the glory of the king comes in multitudes, therefore we're obligated to go together in the synagogue. But in reality, the day would demand of its own essence would demand that each person should be off by themselves, not in a crowd. So that demands some reflection. Let's talk about two sources of, what shall we call them? Two sources, we'll call them right now, two sources of bondage. We will refer to them as the evil without and the evil within. Or, if you will, we can call them objective evil and subjective evil. Or, yet another term which will suffice will be the tyranny of a non-Jewish source as opposed to the tyranny within and from a Jewish source. Let's talk about the evil without. From the very first description of the creation of man, there appears a very menacing, malevolent figure referred to as the Nachash, the primordial serpent. The Nachash is a figure in our literature which asserts the fact that there is an objective presence in the world which is evil and diabolic, whose purpose it is to darken the horizons of man's spiritual quest, to come between man and God, confuse, to mislead, whatever. It is a destructive, punishing, and dark force. It is not merely the absence of light. It is a malevolent, a positive, substantive malevolent presence. We call that generally the satan. And in English they call it Satan. We acknowledge that force by the symbolism of the Nachash, and it is present throughout the sacred Jewish writings. In most cases, we need not flatter ourselves that the Satan is after us. There, the cases in which the Satan would interest himself in us as individuals would require that we be giants of spiritual stature. The Satan, for example, is found attacking or testing Avraham Avinu when he went to the Akedah. The Satan is found attacking or testing Job, but he's not busy with us small fry. Mainly because we do such a good job ourselves. One of the Rabbeim once came out and he found this Hasidim engaged in discussion. And he said to him, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "We're discussing about the various ways in which the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, pursues us." So he said to them, "You guys are in left field." I mean, he didn't say it quite that way, but he said to them, "You guys are in left field." He said, "You're not anywhere near that lofty station." He said, "You're still where you're pursuing the Yetzer Hara. Let's get it straight. Who's pursuing whom?" But the presence of the Satan is nonetheless a malevolent presence which does manifest itself in some very powerful ways in every generation. Its presence is seen in trying to affect in general the environment in which we live and the temptations and trials and tribulations in which all of us as a civilization or perhaps as a society must come up against. We might identify such revolutionary forces as the Industrial Revolution as being one of those changes that threw a whole new array of trials and tests and tribulations against the integrity of people. It affected the work ethic. It affected the sociology of the family. What? Future Shock. Almost every ism, by the way, represents a force that tests our integrity and that really has claimed throughout the generations millions and millions of Jewish victims. Totalitarianism claimed a great many Jewish victims. Christianity claimed many hundreds of thousands of Jewish victims, millions of Jewish victims. Capitalism has claimed many victims. And in the many ways in which it manifests itself, and we have to deal with it. The kinds of pursuits that capitalism as a system, as an economic system, places in our environment. Competition for who's, you know, for keeping up with the Joneses. More and more creature comforts that are blandishments to our weaknesses and our vulnerability. Socialism, intellectualism, from its scientific and its secular perspective. Feminism.
The
very good.
the effects of the sexual revolution, promiscuity, AIDS, live-in arrangements, intermarriage, pornography. And we contend with those things today in a way in which they have not been contended with ever before in the past. There has never been such explicit. There has never before been such an openness, such a latitude. Media are a trial all unto themselves. They are not only powerful in the saturation with which they present themselves, but the science behind advertising, behind public relations, behind Madison Avenue is awesome. If many of us knew what went into the making of an advertisement, we would never again look at an advertisement. It is one of the most offensive things that happen. They test different words, sentences, explicitly, indirectly, subliminally, in all kinds of ways. They sit people in theater chairs with little electrodes attached to their hands to see when they sweat, even if they are not consciously aware of what their reaction is, in order to find out which things work. The fact that we live with a very provocative environment and in a very powerful environment from the standpoint of media is a test which we need to live with. The fact then that we deal with a whole array of, and by the way, once upon a time was other things. So the diabolic and the destructive manifested itself in the various forms of repression and oppression and totalitarianism and feudalism and disease and all of the primitive trappings of those times. But these are all tests which confront the human being outside of paradise in a world which is basically a hostile world. The serpent drove man out of paradise and now deals with him not on man's territory, not on God's territory, not on man's turf, but on his turf. And it is a begrudging turf. It is a turf that does not surrender itself easily to man. It attacks him, it thwarts him, it tests him, it destroys him. So the evil without, the tyranny of the non-Jewish influences, objective, if you will, objective evil, is something that we deal with and have dealt with throughout history, every day of our lives, every moment of the day. Then we have the evil within, the subject. And those are the things that we ourselves compound and complicate. We make decisions which are based on convenience rather than principle. We make decisions which are based on pleasure rather than principle. We make decisions which are based on gain and profit rather than principle. And to that extent, we not only have the inclinations with which we were born to follow our appetites, but we have compounded. Each person has their own unique, peculiar, personal Yetzer Hara. Nobody else made it. We made it. Our decisions have created appetites within us which are not all very, very real at all. They are exaggerated. We have, through our own forms of self-indulgence, we have made for ourselves all kinds of needs to which we have become habituated, which make earnest demands upon our time and upon our best energies. Each one of us has his own unique Yetzer Hara. There is an evil within. Now this is, by the way, this is already our own doing. We are not any longer speaking about a bondage of a non-Jewish origin. We are talking about the bondage of our own origin. we can see really, by the way, in that early model of Adam and Gan Eden, the change, or the two forces at work. There is the Nachash, the Satan without. He represents the global trial. And once he has trapped man, he is no longer singularly outside of man. He still remains outside of man. But he is now also within. When Adam and Eve ate of the Eitz Hadas, of the tree of knowledge, evil became not only an objective force, it now also became an inward force. So in that little incident over there, we had these two forms of evil coming into being. First, the appearance of the Nachash, and secondly, the appearance of the evil within man, where suddenly, because of that appearance of evil within man, of his own making, man realizes that he is naked. Now let's see how tradition deals with these two forms of servitude and bondage. We have one holiday, Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yetzias Mitzrayim is a non-Jewish bondage. It represents Egypt, that is a totalitarian force that imposes its will, its designs, its program upon Israel. And it has its own mitzvahs. There is the eating of the matzah and the morer and the bitter herb, and there is the Korban Pesach and so on, all of which are necessary for the Jews to free themselves from this bondage. But there are some very important dimensions that we need to recognize. First of all, it is a time of national emancipation. That is, that Jews were redeemed as a nation. In fact, God had to wait until there was the exact number of people present before he could redeem them. There had to be exactly 603,000, whatever it was, I can't remember, some change. There had to be exactly that number of people before God could free them, and before God could give the Torah. That is the definition of a nation. It is a national emancipation. What it suggests is that when we need to deal with any of the objective evils that we have to contend with, that it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, for us to try to free ourselves from them as individuals. We need to work and support groups. The Korban Pesach was brought b'chabura. It was brought in groups. Family groups, groups of social groups, but it had to be brought with a chabura. There was no way really in which it was practically possible to bring the Korban Pesach alone. So, if we need to deal with the variety of things which are part of the challenges and the trials of our time, we need to find strength in sharing in one another and coming together and trying to do things that will give us some way of combating the evils that surround us. Things like day schools, things like yeshivas, things like learning groups, perhaps supportive communities where people who share certain common values live in close proximity to one another so that they can be supportive to one another as they face the problems of their times. For people to be able to do with perhaps some of the what appear to be today the necessary amenities of life requires some group support. To give up a TV set today is not an easy thing to do unless there are other families whose kids also don't watch TV, whose kids also don't go. It's almost impossible to enforce any kind of standard upon individual children. that will allow it to be effective. So the freedom from some of the global and objective evils needs to be done as part of a larger group. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur commemorate the appearance of one single human being. Rosh Hashanah is the day upon which one little man appeared on the scene. It's the day upon which that lonely figure with his helpmeet committed a crucial sin. Gemara says, "Lama nevra adam yichidi? Why was man created alone? Why didn't God create a world teeming with millions of people?" The answer is so that each person would be able to say and believe, to say with conviction, "Bishvili nivrayalam." The world is worth it for one person, and I too must find myself as that person. In other words, I have to live in such a way that the creation of the world is worth it for me. The creation of the world must be vindicated in the way in which I live. It is the day upon which subjective evil came into being. Consequently, Rosh Hashanah is the day upon which we initiate a year, not the year in which we try to contend with the larger forces of the natural world in which we live that belong to the rest of the world. This is a day upon which we begin the disciplined effort to free ourselves from the tyranny that we ourselves have brought into our own lives, the subjective evil, the evil within. And we need to do it, and we need to do it in our own unique private and personal way. Despite the fact that we are going to appear in the synagogue, as the Baal Shem Tov indicated, it's a day upon which, in essence, we would do best were it not for the other demands of the day, which demand that we come to shul. But in spirit, it's a day that would say, each person should be alone in their homes, because it's really a day of solitude. A day in which we need to confront ourselves, not as part of a larger whole, but because we need to begin the process of freeing ourselves up from our own shtick, from our own hang-ups, from the ways in which we perceive and interpret the world because of the ways in which we have complicated our own lives. There are two pairs of luchos, the first and the second. The first was given on the holiday that is associated with Pesach, and they were given publicly, just as Pesach was a public liberation. The giving of the Torah in the first instance was a public declaration, it was a public conferral of sanctity and consecration upon the people of Israel. The second time that the Torah was given, it was given privately, and it was given on Yom Kippur, because that's part of that unit of time in which we need to deal with the giving of the Torah in a very personal way. We need to see how we relate and how we stack up to the needs and the demands of the Torah from our own personal standpoint. Similarly, the Akedah. According to that opinion that the Akedah took place on Yom Kippur, that was an event which tested Avram at the most fundamental level. Avram had passed all the tests. He had demonstrated the fact that he was capable of transcending every personal agenda. The question was, could he transcend the personal agenda of having a son to carry on his sacred work? Now, there was no more sacred thing to him than to have this beloved son, to whom and in whom he had invested every effort, to carry on that which he believed in. But that too is a personal agenda in a way, is it not? That too has some sort of, in its own very subtle way, an ego-related item Avram, can you overcome even that agenda? That took place on Yom Kippur, the day upon which we finalize our ability to transcend and get beyond the complications of our own lives. We have a six-day week. Six-day week is a week which is dominated by the objective demands of the Satan's world, the extra, supra, as it were, paradise, not supra, but extra paradise world. Comes the Shabbos, we step out. And we try to get a perspective on how we can raise ourselves above the tyranny of the many global evils that live in our time. Similarly, for 6 years we till the soil. And we belong, in a certain sense, to the soil, but for 1 year we find out if we can raise ourselves beyond the tyranny of those global demands that are made by an agrarian society, the law of which is, by the sweat of your brow you will eat bread. For 6 years, someone who is in servitude works for his master, and on the seventh year he goes free to test his own ability to be a free person. But after one has gone through seven such cycles, there comes a time called Yovel. And in Yovel, we test ourselves not against the global evils. We test ourselves in the Yovel against our own personal needs to be dependent based upon what we invited. How does a person go free? What kind of a person goes free on Yovel? A person who himself invited his state of servitude. We're talking about a person who complicated his life. He's a person who said, Ahavti es Adoni, I love my master. I love the world in which I live. I love the state of my life. I'm comfortable with who I am. I don't want to leave my state of servitude. As Ishti ves Bonai, the many, many things that I am married to, as it were. Yovel is a time in which a person is able to transcend not only, or to cope with not only those global evils, but to deal with the personal complications, the evils of his own doing. We need to understand within this frame of reference that we have created an instrument that is the Korban Pesach is going to help us contend with the global evil. Our supportive community will help us contend with the global evil. But now we're talking about our own Yetzer Hara, the tyranny from within. A Jewish tyranny, not a non-Jewish tyranny. Influences that we ourselves have invited. So now, we need an instrument that's going to free us. I would like to talk about one form of inner tyranny, which is perhaps the singularly most powerful and controlling and frightening form of inner tyranny. We addressed it earlier. We can call it by a variety of names: status quo, complacency, I am what I am. I am pleased with myself. I'm okay, to borrow a phrase from transactional analysis. Don't rock the boat. The acceptance of self. And I think we really need to ask ourselves, however impressive our status quo may be, by the way, there are some very great people. People who have made a lot of themselves. And when Rosh Hashanah comes, they may say to themselves, you know, I've done a good job. Dare anybody, however impressive their status quo may be, dare anybody say to themselves, Adka, this is, I'm leaving it here. I'm not growing beyond you. I'm not going to challenge myself beyond you. Is there anybody who has the right to say, I cannot be better, I cannot seek greater excellence, I cannot go back and ferret out within my personality certain, however imperceptible but nonetheless ever-present faults, flaws, weaknesses, vulnerabilities? Is there such a person? It wasn't Avram, and it wasn't Yitzchak, and it wasn't Yaakov, and it wasn't Moshe. So who's it going to be? Many years ago, I picked up a soft-covered book, one of those pocketbook editions of a work by a psychiatrist, a guy by the name of Dr. Flack. I'm calling upon him only because he says rather well something that most of us in our experience have observed, and something which is quoted in a variety of different ways in many of our traditional writings. This fellow wrote a number of books, one of which is called The Secret Strength of Depression, an interesting book. The second is called Choices, Coping Creatively with Personal Change. And he identifies in this book that all change, he says, has three basic components. All change has three basic components. The first one is, he calls, impact. That is, a person is in a certain state, things are going along in a certain way, and all of a sudden there is stress. It could be anything. Could be sickness, could be marital instability, could be chas v'shalom death, could be whatever. Could be a million and one different things. Could be that they went to a class. They went to a class or Rosh Hashanah. I don't know. Could be lots of different things. There is impact. The next step he calls imbalance. This impact dislodges the person's equilibrium. He is now in a state of confusion. It's almost as though a person were a puzzle that's all together, and you give them a smash and all the pieces fly out. And the person doesn't know how to put them back together anymore. He's in a state of really of disintegration. And the third state he calls healing and restoration or reintegration. And he denotes that there are two forms of reintegration. A person has an infection, let's say, in his hand, and it's treated with antibiotics. The hope is that the hand, after the treatment, will be as good as it was before. But in this series of events that he describes, he asserts that the ideal goal is an organism which comes together in a way which is stronger than it was before. And he insists that if we were to look, at most creative, really great creative efforts, both historically and in our own lives, we would discover that they are products of stress, of an impact and an imbalance, and of a coming together that created some new way of dealing with our situation. That's the proverbial darkness before the light, or the suffering before the reward, or the irritation before the oyster produces the pearl. We go through periods of uncertainty, we go through periods of fear, we go through periods of feeling that we have a loss of control. But he insists that all of these things, and he calls, by the way, all of these things by the name depression, despite the fact that they aren't real depression, they're not pathological depression. But he calls all of those things non-pathological depression. And he says that this form of depression
leads to a reintegration that creates bigger and better things. All of us make the same observation in a lot of different ways. Tzadikim chilasin yisurim v'sev and shalva. The righteous go through, they go through hell, they go through all forms of suffering in order to reach a state of tranquility and peace. But there is no question about the fact that no matter where we look, we discover that in order to chart a new course for ourselves, that we must confront ourselves, that we must expose our weaknesses, our flaws, our faults, our failings, our vulnerabilities. We must be able to articulate a direction that we are interested in going that is a better direction, and we need to experience all of those feelings that come out of leaving a secure place that we are already accustomed to. We've already made it a certain place. We know what to expect where we are. We may be comfortable where we are, but to the extent that as Jews we are not allowed to remain in any state of complacency, we must brave the unknown, uncertain world of disintegration, of finding that we're not in control of all the parts because we have embarked on a new step. So we need to take our routine, we need to take the stabilization that we have worked so hard on, we need to take all of our environment, all of our emotions, and we need to move forward. And that is the voice of the shofar. The shofar represents the inner breath of man, his inner essence. The sound of the shofar can only be created when we blow from within ourselves to create a sound. What is that sound? First sound is an even sound. It's a solid, firm blast. It's the human being as we start out on Rosh Hashanah. Then there's the impact, and the impact creates a truer. It creates a person who is suddenly finds himself, because of the fact that he dares to brave a new world, he finds himself crying for his old world, for the disintegration of that which was, for the loss of his secure position. So we have the sobs, and we have the staccato cries, all of which represent the fact that a person is now engaged in his travel. He is in an odyssey. He has left one place. Abraham became a nation, became a patriarch, when Hashem said to him, Lech Lecha, you got to leave. When we are engaged in the process of Lech Lecha, when we have left behind us the things that we knew best, the things that we were most familiar with, we then came into a new world. And it was so far, it's a world in which we don't know yet where we are, how we're going to, where the pieces are going to fall. So we are frightened. And there is a sound of weeping, which is the acknowledgement of our faults, a sound of weeping, which is an acknowledgement of the fact that we have left our security, a sound of weeping, which is an acknowledgement of the fact that we are heading someplace, El Ha'aretz Asher Arecha, and we don't know where that is. Other than the fact that we know what we would like it. Rosh Hashanah, in the terms of the approach that we spoke of earlier, is the stress. It's a self-imposed stress. Nobody comes along. Rosh Hashanah comes along and says, stress yourself. Impact. You must take the complacency of your life, the tyranny of mediocrity, and subject it once again to the light of excellence. You, as a Jew, you do not have the prerogative of enjoying or indulging mediocrity. That is, that word, that state, at whatever level it appears, is to the Jewish perspective is anathema. It's an insufferable place to be. So you may have a very great tzaddik, person who is stands shoulder and above. But for him, his status quo is mediocrity. there is far more that he can do, and he's not permitted to enjoy his mediocrity. The last tekiah represents the assurance that having proceeded as we're supposed to proceed, that all the pieces will come together, and that not only will they come together, not only will there be a stabilization, not only will there be something that is firm, that will bring us a sense of knowing who we are, where we are, secure in our new identity, but it will be a tekiah gedola. It will be a tekiah that will be bigger, better, stronger, louder than where we were before. So the last sound that we sound is a tekiah gedola, and it is the single blast that is characteristic of Yom Kippur, because it is that blast which really frees Jewish slaves from Jewish master. It is on the Yovel that we don't go free from Egypt, we go free from Jews. And in this case, Yom Kippur, every Yom Kippur, is our own microscopic jubilee, where we sound the shofar to signal the fact that we have successfully moved through these stages from the beginning of Rosh Hashanah through the Aseres Yemei Tshuva to the conclusion of this day, and that we are now in a position to return to the dignity which is our birthright. The word shofar itself shares a root with the Aramaic word meaning shufa, which implies beauty. And the sound of the shofar, regardless of where a person is a summons to greater excellence and greater beauty. So the sound of the shofar is particularly apropos for the freeing of Jews from slavery. And it's for this reason that historically this day is tied in with the freeing up, the liberation of Joseph from slavery. Joseph left his personal dungeon and became a king. And that is within the scope of every Jew on between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, is to leave their own personal dungeon and prison and move towards the royalty to which they were born. The word Tishrei, parenthetically, again in the Aramaic, means to untie. So that the month of Tishrei, which is the month in which we celebrate this event, is the month in which we try to untie ourselves from the tyranny of our own past counterfeit. So what do we do? Now the question is a practical one. We know what we have to do. This is not Pesach. We're not dealing with the nations of the world. We're not dealing with an enemy. We're not dealing with Haman. We're not dealing with Hitler. We're not dealing with Lavan. We're not dealing with Pharaoh. We're dealing with an enemy that looks like us. In fact, I've met the enemy, and he is us. Or he is me, however you want to say that. So what do you do when you need to confront yourself? What are the steps? I believe that the steps run somewhat along these lines. First of all, and I'm convinced it won't work any other way, we need to create some quiet time for ourselves. It's impossible in the midst of a routine. It's impossible in the midst of our busyness. It's impossible in the stream of things to say to ourselves that we can figure out where we've been, what we've done, where we want to go. It's not going to happen. You need to create some solitude. And it's got to be solitude that you have programmed. You've got to say to yourself, on this and this day, I am taking off whatever it is that you want to take off, as much time as you feel you need, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever it is. You say to yourself, this is time that I am going to confront what I need to confront. I need to look at myself. I need to see where I am falling short of the things that secretly I believe in, the things that I have longed to do for years and years, the faults that I have excoriated myself for and criticized myself for years and years, that I've done nothing about. We need to confront our weaknesses the things that that the habituations, the conditioning, all of these things. We need to take time in solitude, and during the period of solitude, we need to make some realistic judgment of what we can bite off. During the course of that solitude, we need to say to ourselves, this year, this is my goal. It is an achievable goal. I'm not biting off too much. Next year I'll take another step. This year I want to reach beyond my mediocrity into a better life. And here is my goal. And you say to yourself, this is my commitment. After you've done that, the next step is say it out loud. Hear yourself say it. Very important. When you finish doing that, then turn around to the wall and pray. Say to Hashem, Master of the world, you are my father, I am your child. This is the product of my introspection, my reflection. This is the product of my thought. This is the product of my solitude. These are my goals. These are my expressions. Here's what I want to do. Please help me. The next step is find a trusted friend. Find a trusted friend and tell somebody what you committed yourself to, so that somebody else also knows about it. Somebody who will, by your mandate, your charge, remind you from time to time, or ask you from time to time how you're doing. Create a timetable of when you're going to do what to get to where you want to get. Make sure that your timetable represents steps that you can realistically and successfully take. Try to break them up so that you can be successful. Success is a great reinforcement. The next step is to pray some more. Actually, you ought to do that all the time. The next step is try to learn as much as you possibly can about the realm of your commitment. Become conversant in what you've committed yourself to is in authentic Jewish terms. Try to find out all about it. Try to find out why it's important. Try to find out what its details are. Try to find out what its extensions are. Try to find out what its ultimate horizons are. But try to find out. Become learned. Become educated in your goals. It's one thing to know that it's important. It's another thing to know how important it is and where it fits in, and the many ways in which that characteristic that you're pursuing manifests itself. Last but perhaps not least, and perhaps it's something that should appear earlier in the order, I have many times urged many of the members of our congregation to give thought to the possibility of taking or having a, just like there is an annual physical exam, to have an annual spiritual exam. Sit down with someone who is in a position to be somewhat detached and objective to your person. Someone who may have some insight into some of those sources that you are going to be learning about, and have them put together in some sort of an equation the many factors of your life that you're dealing with, and perhaps advise you on what it is that you should be considering during your moments of solitude, and how you can make your goals more achievable, and how you can break them up into steps that will be successful. In the last analysis, the only way to go free during this period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so that from the sound of the shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah to the sound of the shofar that invites us to go back to our inherent dignity. We're not dealing on something that's dependent upon all kinds of national events. We're talking about something which is a deeply personal holiday, and something which will be successful insofar as we ourselves do for ourselves what we need to do. So if we want to get out of this Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, what we can get out of this Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, let it be known that we will only get what we are willing ourselves. Don't count on the rabbi. Don't count on the chauffeur to do it for you. Don't count on the synagogue that you go to. Don't count on the holiday to wave a magic wand. Nothing will work unless there is a personal investment on our own. If we put in a personal investment on our own, then the synagogue, the chauffeur, the magic of Rosh Hashanah, the magic of Yom Kippur, the intervention and the guidance and the counsel of the significant others in our lives will all be effective. But it begins with our recognition that this is a time of personal freedom from forms of bondage that are really self-imposed, and that if we want to be able to escape our own mediocrity, that we need to put in, we, ourselves, I, alone, each person in their own realm and in their own place needs to put in the effort to go free. And God willing, when we hear the shofar Motzei Yom Kippur, when we have fasted and we've discovered that we can live without some of the creature comforts that we believe to be so indispensable, we will discover that this season has truly set us on a new course, and that we are experiencing a new feeling of freedom that we didn't know before.